We know that faith-based communities are a protective factor for mental health for the majority. You know, there are lower suicide rates in people who are actively involved in a faith-based community, and that's across the board. But we also know that for some people, faith can be a source of conflict. You know, this idea of independence being, you know, what we value in Western culture. But actually, when you look at sort of more Eastern cultures, there's much more of a sense of value placed on being part of a reciprocal relationship with people. You know, communities and faith communities are able to really sort of be a part of that interdependence opposed to independence, I think, within a society that, that maybe thinks of otherwise. Rabbiting on.
Welcome back to Rabbiting On. I'm Rabbi Debbie Young-Summers. It is a pleasure, as always, to be joined by my colleagues this week. Rabbi Miriam Berger is here with me. Hello, Miriam.
Hello. Good to see you. Sorry I was late.
A little fire alarm emergency at Miriam's end. And we're sending our love to Rabbi Robin, who can't be with us this week, but we're thinking of her and sending lots of love and strength. What have you been up to, Miriam?
I mean, it has been exciting. We just had two fire engines arrive at the synagogue for an unintentional fire drill, but we're very proud that the protocols work and everyone got out the building. And luckily, there was no smoke. In this case, there was smoke without fire or something like that.
Is it still exciting having fire engines and firemen arrive? Like, does it make you feel childlike?
Well, when you've got a kindergarten in the building as well, I think their excitement is kind of infectious. There's something about, I'm going to be gendered here and say little boys and fire engines, that you can't not face the excitement. And there's something to do with our office staff, where again, I'm going to be gendered and say older women and firemen, equal excitement, I think, at both ends of the scale. So yes, it was just a momentary excitement.
I used to be super proud that Eliana played with dolls and played with cars and had, you know, fire engines and trucks and helicopters. And I remember talking to an educator who'd come to stay with us after Limud. And, you know, we were discussing the gender roles and toys and how ridiculous it all is. And I said, you know, Eliana has everything. She played them. And literally as the words were coming out of my mouth, she walked into the lounge pushing a buggy, which had a helicopter inside it. She then takes the helicopter out of the buggy and starts brushing its hair.
She maybe was playing with the helicopter differently to how some boys might play with helicopters.
Bit upsetting.
Maybe.
So this Saturday, this Shabbat, in fact, has been dedicated to be Mental Health Shabbat. It's an annual occurrence which originated and was sponsored by the Jewish charity Jamie, who work in all of our communities to support and advise and help all of us with mental health. And we are delighted this morning to be joined by our very special guest, Louise Kermode, who is from Jamie. Welcome to you, Louise.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Any crazy toy stories from your kid?
No, just I remember sort of wishing that, you know, my son would be into Lego, because I really liked Lego and I was really excited that I had a boy, and I was like, oh, good, we can get stuck into the Lego. And he just refused to play with it. And I was just really disappointed by that.
I'm more disappointed that Lego now comes in girl versions and boy versions. I think that's rubbish.
Yeah.
I don't think girls will ever struggle to play with yellow and red and blue and green bricks.
My son showed more of his propensity to be a project manager than a construction engineer when he insisted on just sitting watching me and my husband make Lego on his behalf. But maybe we should have just sent him round to you, because you'd have really enjoyed that, Louise.
Yeah, that's right.
That happens quite a lot in our house as well. We end up finishing the big, great projects that our children have begged us for. But I think the toy episode is probably for another time.
It's when you watch them doing it wrong as well and you want to step in and do it properly. That's the bit that gets
me.
You can't
skip steps. It doesn't work. So, I mean, Lego could very well tie in with what we're talking about this morning, the meditative effects of having something to focus on and achieve through building a big build. But of course, Mental Health Shabbat isn't a new thing. It's something that's been around, oh, I don't know how long, but maybe at least a decade. Louise, do you know how long Mental Health Shabbat's been with us?
You're testing me now. It's definitely a good few years. Yeah, it's definitely, definitely coming up to that. Yeah. And I remember the first one that we did. You know, there was a sort of handful of communities, and it's now, you know, or probably almost 100 communities. And the beginning, it was sort of a lot of the Jamie professional and lay team going out and doing all the gigs. And now what's wonderful is that, you know, communities are doing it for themselves. You know, they're running their own mental health awareness Shabbat using our resources, but really we're not having to go in. And that just shows how mental health literacy has increased over the last few years, I think.
We're doing several different things over the course of the weekend. And I think actually there's a committee that are responsible for helping to make that happen within the synagogue, which I suspect also isn't historically something that's always been part of the synagogue makeup. Yeah. Although, of course, mental health Shabbat is relatively new, mental health has always been around, and how we deal with it as communities, I think, has really radically shifted in the last few years. Has Jamie been seeing that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember going to do sort of talks around, you know, mental health awareness, and you sort of ask people to raise their hand who has mental health, and there would be very few hands raised. You know, now you ask that question, everyone's like, yes, we all have mental health, and we have a much better understanding of what that is and how to take care of it. And I think that that's a real positive. And I think it can also present some challenges around sort of how we're encouraged to take care of ourselves. And sometimes I think that can be a difficult dialogue when you're struggling with your mental health. You know, we have a spectrum, and, you know, when we're doing all right and we're keeping ourselves going and we know what to do to help take care of ourselves. But when we're at the other end of the spectrum, near a sort of mental ill health, distress, I think that narrative can be challenging as well. So I think it's a double-edged sword for me.
It's fascinating to me also seeing a new generation grow up with a language around their mental health, which is totally acceptable and totally part of the norm. It was when I heard one of my son's friends saying to him, you know, I just don't think I can be friends with her. She's just not good for my mental health. Now, having been at an all-girls secondary school myself, that language might have been quite useful back in the day. But that, you know, that wasn't language that we had. And it's really interesting to hear our teenagers being able to acknowledge that actually some of that just doesn't make me feel, you know, that person doesn't make me feel good. That person messes with my head is a really useful part of their language.
I think that's right. And I think kids are more empowered now, aren't they? Because it's you know, we know about setting healthy boundaries. That's something we hear a lot of. In fact, we're saturated with, you know, the idea of setting healthy boundaries for ourselves. And the fact that we've got young adults and teenagers and children understanding how to talk about their feelings and also understanding how to set those sort of boundaries for themselves, I think is incredible.
I feel really worried, though, for our, particularly our teenagers. And I think you're right, there is definitely a language that they have now, but I'm really conscious of how widespread mental health challenges are for our teenagers and for everyone, really. But I think particularly our teenagers, you know, they've come through the isolation of the pandemic, the interruptions of the pandemic. But we know even before that, that schools were struggling to deal with anorexia, with all sorts of different mental health challenges, which I think in and of themselves might well be a pandemic. I don't know if that is the language that the professional community would use, but it feels at pandemic levels to some extent.
Yeah, we haven't started to see the full impact of the pandemic yet in terms of mental health. And to be honest, it was pretty bad before in terms of waiting lists for statutory services and, you know, the thresholds for support is so high, you know, people are constantly turned away because they're not ill enough for support. And I think that's really, really hard. So, I mean, I certainly know the work that we do, you know, the work that used to be done by statutory services and sort of care coordination and mental health teams, you know, we're seeing increasingly that we're picking up that work as a charity. And so the sort of last 10 years I've been working in this space, there's been a real shift in that work. So it was already a bit dire in terms of waiting lists and mental health. And then you're right, the pandemic has been an interruption for all of us. I'd say just a word of kind of balance. For our kids, that's their norm. Some are going to be okay. They're going to adjust and you know, they're going to be fine. That's their normal. And for others, it's going to be more problematic. And I think we also know that we might have all been in the same storm during the pandemic, and there's a great anonymous poem on you can Google, but we were in very different boats. Inequalities were heightened, we shone a torch on those, you know, from terms of physical and mental health, and now we're in a cost of living crisis. And I think mental health doesn't discriminate in that sense. You know, we are all vulnerable to having mental health issues and struggling with our well-being in that sense, but we also know that social, political, financial inequality makes you far more likely to have an issue with your mental health, or that having poor mental health will create more inequality as well. So I think that's really the sort of landscape we're in. And I think it's really interesting when people sort of say, you know, you've got a mental health issue, you know, you need therapist, you need sort of psychology, you need counselling. Absolutely, that's a really, really helpful part of the puzzle, and to help build resilience and to, you know, support people to cope with their symptoms and what's troubling them in their life. But actually, another really important thing is that systemic stuff that we work with. So people need housing, secure housing. People need, you know, food and heating, and people need connection. And, you know, I think a lot of the well-being content, which talks about, you know, go and talk to a friend, go outside, go to the gym, go to yoga, all these different things, it assumes quite a lot about having access to those things, and even access to people to connect with, I think is really difficult for people in, you know, who are struggling.
Yeah, I think as communities, we quite often end up picking that stuff up and finding those gaps, and, you know, those people who have been waiting come to us for resource, but also for support. But also a lot of people don't know that their synagogue is a place that can support them and help them with these things. Does Jamie often find themselves filling in the gaps that public services have failed?
Absolutely. And certainly, you know, we're really committed to our day services for people for whom, you know, probably you always need a certain level of support and certainly need somewhere to connect, somewhere safe to belong. And those services don't really exist out in statutory services anymore. And I think that idea of community is really, really interesting. I've worked in the Jewish community for over 10 years now, and it's an incredible thing to be a part of. But that word, even that term Jewish community, you know, assumes this homogenous group of people, when actually it's so diverse. There is so much about what Jewish community means to different people. And I often think about those who aren't connected with their synagogue or aren't connected with other community groups that exist in the Jewish community. You know, what happens to sort of those people who maybe feel like, you know, and I know there's been so much change in terms of making those spaces more accessible for people with mental ill health. There's been some amazing progress there. But I think there are a lot of people that fall in the gaps. And I think the cafe that we have in Golders Green, Headroom, I think that's an example of where people don't have to refer into our service. You don't have to give us your details and go through an assessment process. And you can just go and be, you can go and just have a coffee. You can join in a group. You can be part of a community where there's, I guess, mutual support.
And it is excellent
because
coffee.
I think it's really good coffee and a great lunch as well. And there's something about it's run by our peer support team. So I think there's really something about mutual support. I think, you know, we often find ourselves rescuing when we want to support people and help people. And I think it's all for good reason, but we end up disempowering those we're trying to help. I think, you know, our model is about peer support, about mutuality, and about kind of coaching people and empowering people. So yeah, it's kind of encouraging that sense of giving and receiving support needs to be more normalised and less stigmatised. You know, I think that's a real challenge.
We also have to remember that actually for a lot of people, the Jewish community can also be part of the challenge, right? It's part of the keeping up with the levies. It's part of the kind of claustrophobia of what it means to be functioning within community can also have its own pressures that are associated with that as well. And it's why I'm fascinated by the fact that Mental Health Shabbat, it always falls when we're reading about the plagues. And I see that very much as what happens when actually societal structures are at the root cause of some of the challenges we face. So seeing the plagues less as kind of the thing that's kind of inflicted on us, but rather as the thing that kind of, when society is constructed with challenges at its core, what the product of that can be, sometimes, you know, devastating effects. And so much of the mental health issues that we see within community are part of, are a product of how our communities are constructed, both kind of community with a, you know, Jewish edge,
yeah,
and society at large, and how we work to unpick society's structure in order to be able to support people as best we can with mental illness.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, whilst comparing mental health to physical health is not always helpful, sometimes it can be problematic. And there are sort of schools of people who agree and disagree with using the so just a caveat that it's not always an aligned sort of comparison. But there is something about, you know, the social model of disability that is often referred to when we're talking about physical health. And we think about, you know, it's not the person who is using a wheelchair who is disabled. It's the fact that the cafe doesn't have a ramp to get into it. So it's sort of thinking about how we can make services accessible from a mental health perspective. It's you know, it can be a little bit more challenging to get your head around because it's not straightforward as here's some equipment, here's a ramp, here's a, you know, it's how we can create a culture of that really. But I think it's really important to note that, you know, when we look at the person being the issue, the person has issues, the person has mental ill health, the person is distressed, actually, is it that, or is it that we are not creating the right environment for people to thrive? And I think the other challenge of the narrative we have around sort of well-being and mental health as well is that the onus is on us to look after ourselves. And I think that's really important. We should be empowered to take care of ourselves. And I'm not saying that's a problem, but I think when we go down the other end of the spectrum and people do need taking care of and we do need to support each other. And I think a great analogy, a psychologist who was doing a keynote speaker at a conference I was at was talking about, you know, if someone can't tie their shoes and they have a learning disability, we get them shoes with Velcro on. We would provide something to make it easier for that person to engage in the activities that bring meaning and that sense of belonging. So yeah, I just think it's a really interesting dialogue that we should be opening up.
Miriam, your analogy of the plagues has made me think about the idea that we try to support everyone communally together, but actually we've got different plagues, right? There are different challenges that everyone faces. And I think it's a really interesting parallel to the what I see as one of the challenges of being a progressive Jew, which is we really value the individual and the individual experience, the individual choices people make. And when it comes to mental health, that individuality is really important, that we respond to where people are. On the flip side, we also have to find ways to function as a community and to be together as a community. And it's that the challenge of the balance, you know, the same things aren't going to work for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that's a minefield in itself. We're constantly, and I'm constantly looking at trends and, you know, people who are maybe more at risk and, you know, what are the kind of evidence-based interventions that we should be doing, you know, developing as a service. But actually, that's all really helpful. And it's really helpful to kind of to be looking at that. But actually, the most helpful thing that we do as a service is to listen to people who use services, listen to people who have had experience of mental ill health. So it's yes, you know, you have to think about how we function as a service, how we function as communities, how we kind of put structures in place to operate, you know, services that are of benefit to people. But there's got to allow that room for individuality. You know, everyone's experience is different. Everyone has a different take on what it means to them. And I think, you know, an example, again, of thinking around the sort of link to faith, we know that faith-based communities are a protective factor for mental health for the majority. You know, there are lower suicide rates in people who are actively involved in a faith-based community. And that's across the board. But we also know that for some people, faith can be a source of conflict. And being, as you mentioned earlier, being part of a community can be, you know, if you're not part of it, that can also be a real conflict. So it's that nuance between, yes, you know, what's the broader picture, but allowing for everyone to be able to express their own unique experience.
Right. Or if you feel judged or excluded from community, how much more so that piece is something that has that constant negative effect on you. I've been reading a fascinating book. Noreena Hertz has written a book on called The Lonely Century, and comes back to this idea of like all the different factors that are sort of emerging at this time or converging at this time that are leading to that kind of isolation, that breakdown in society, that breakdown of a sense of being responsible one for each other. And she looks at the Haredi community and shows that actually it can have a positive effect on the number of years you live, even, you know, that your lifespan is increased by being held within a tight-knit sense of community and the benefits that can offer, although we know that it certainly doesn't work for everybody in that way.
There's been a lot of research done around sort of different cultures in terms of sort of how societies operate. So, you know, this idea of independence being, you know, what we value in Western culture. You know, we value that sense that we are taking care of ourselves. We're looking at, we can do it on our own. And that's, you know, that's what we value. That's what we're drip fed through a lot of the systems that we're operating in. But actually, when you look at sort of more Eastern cultures, there's much more of a sense of value placed on being part of a reciprocal relationship with people, where, you know, even the definitions around how people would define anxiety is hugely different. So I think there's a lot to learn, I think, around how different societies operate and what we value and how that impacts on our mental health. And I think communities and faith communities are able to really sort of be a bit more of a sort of a part of that interdependence opposed to independence, I think, within a society that maybe thinks of otherwise.
And I think there's a really interesting challenge around what community means to people and how we understand community and build community. The pandemic, I think, for me certainly, really highlighted my need for connection and community and togetherness, and all sorts of alternative communities kind of popped up in different ways. In fact, Reformed Judaism has a shacharit online. It was every day during the pandemic. It's now gone down to Friday mornings, and they've just started an evening service on a Sunday night that only happens on Zoom with people all over the country. And they've become a little knit community that didn't exist before. They're all part of other communities. Producer Dan asked us to wonder about whether rabbiting on is a community, right? When people are connected to something, did those people who came to the live feel that they were part of this rabbiting on community that they could connect to and share with other people? And I think we as communities almost have to constantly reassess and rethink, what does community need for people and how do we build that?
I think the pandemic also created local community, like particularly in London.
Street where, WhatsApp groups.
Right, where we've just never had that sort of connectivity with neighbours. It was wonderful to see. I mean, our street has continued a little bit with that, like, you know, through the function of the WhatsApp group, and we're there a little bit more for each other than perhaps we were. I wonder if anyone's really supporting in the way that they were and really looking out for people in the way that they perhaps were.
Hmm. I think you're right. I think you think about the local Facebook groups kind of sprung up and everyone was checking on their neighbours. And, you know, I worked as an occupational therapist for many years. And so this, you know, idea that that, you know, suddenly everything became accessible to people and we had people doing things for people and with people, and people needed it before. People were disabled before, whether it be through physical health or mental health. People were housebound before the pandemic. And, you know, many continue to be because of their concerns around, you know, people haven't got back to normal yet. You know, some have, some haven't. There's still a spectrum of that. So I think it's, you know, things that came free and accessible online tours of galleries and museums and concerts and all these different sort of cultural things as well that went online. And it was great, but I was also really struck by the people that needed this before. And so can we learn from that, and can we continue to think about how people, you know, continue to need that accessibility? But I think there's a real power in community. I think it was a powerful force during the pandemic.
My worry is what you've shown is that actually until we've actually had to walk in someone else's shoes, we don't really, you know, we don't have the capacity to really think about others in a different situation from us. So it wasn't until we were stuck in our homes that we could really think about, okay, but what's it like for those people who are kind of more confined than even we are? Like, I suspect there's part of that in our everyday and sort of in how we respond to people all the time.
I think you're right.
And I know lots of us have maintained some of that accessibility, but we've also lost a lot of it. And getting that balance right between that desire to be together and that desire to have accessibility is...
Well, it's all based in fear, right? Like the synagogues were very much like, well, if we continue making us this accessible without people walking in the door, well, people never walk in the door again. And actually what we've shown is that remote stuff is a wonderful second best, right? But actually people would always choose, unless there was a reason, that actually they found being within the physical confines of other people and in a physical community a challenge, they'll always choose that primarily, unless they can't choose it.
And there's something about power there, isn't there, that's really interesting. Because we talk about building a community and what does a community mean to different people. And that's, you know, really important. But something about who's making the decision that we need to bring everyone back. You know, this is the better way. This is the better way to engage. This is the way that we are going to engage. Who's making those decisions and what power are we holding over the people within the group that we're working with? So I think there's something really interesting about that and kind of a question around what's okay and what isn't. And so when we're, you know, thinking about community, I think the most powerful thing we can do there is hand that power over to the people within it.
Hearing you talk about kind of making decisions for other people makes me think about kind of who those other people are that we're talking about. Is there a kind of marked difference between how our mental health challenges present differently for men, for women, for children, for older people? Like, do you see trends within mental health issues?
I mean, I think we certainly see, you know, when we're looking at kind of the younger end, children and adolescents, you know, we're often kind of see more, you know, the mental health literacy is getting better and they are talking about, you know, they've got the language for it more now, but you might see more kind of behavioural issues around what's going on there. That might be more of a sort of a sign that something isn't quite right. We certainly see with our sort of older adults, you know, loneliness tends to be a really big factor and they tend to be more unable or unwilling to sort of speak about their mental health. And that's still a bit of a challenge, I think, in older adults. So we might find that, you know, things may get a little bit worse before, you know, someone accesses help. Or so I think there is sort of, we are seeing generationally, there are changes and there are differences and there are different ways it might manifest. Or, you know, we're finding brilliant, you know, at the moment, sort of people around that sort of more middle age group are coming to us without a formal diagnosis. So we're not kind of having people be referred to us following having a diagnosis of mental health. They're actually saying, I know there's something wrong with how I am. I know I'm not coping. So I'm going to reach out for support. And I think that's really positive because we know that early intervention, we know that support early on prevents things from worsening and becoming, you know, to that kind of crisis point where we don't want to get to that point.
So we had Dan Rickman speaking at the synagogue a number of months ago. I know that he and Rabbi Samuel Landau are doing some incredible work looking particularly at men's mental health. Would you say that there's a kind of need to sort of address men's mental health in a different way to women?
Absolutely. We know there's huge risk factors there for men who find it difficult to talk about their mental health. And you know, again, that sense of independence and I need to look after everyone, you know, and I'm the sort of, so I think there's a real issue there. We know that there are suicide rates that are higher in men of a certain age. One of the groups we run at the cafe has been about Get Men Talking. So it's a group specifically for men to come and talk and to sort of really normalize that sense of being able to come and speak about how you're doing and get support from other people who, you know, other men who are probably going through a similar thing and realize that you're not alone. That isolation, I think, can be really challenging for men.
I had a gorgeous experience. I was walking from home to the synagogue one evening and it was dark and there were a big group of men kind of walking behind me, which as a woman walking on your own, you can't like help but have a little bit of like a kind of moment of I hope I'm okay. Like, I hope this is not kind of something that I should be worried about. And one of the guys just picked up his pace a little. So he was walking alongside me, which immediately kind of, you know, made me even more anxious. And he said, I just wanted to put your mind at rest. I know you're being followed by a large group of men walking, but I just wanted to explain. We're a local group who meet once a week just for men who want to be able to chat to each other. It's a walking group. So we don't have to like the intensity of looking into each other's eyes, but it just gives us a space where we can talk and kind of let some of the stresses and strains of the week out to other people who are kind of having their own issues too. And it was so lovely because whilst they were really concentrating on their own need for their mental health, they were clearly aware of how it could be misconstrued and how I was misconstruing that sort of that feel of a large group of men. So also that sense of not only what we project onto people, but what they take on board of what's being projected onto them. And therefore like that sense of responsibility too.
That's a really brilliant illustration. I think what a mensch that he realised and came and so reached out. So I think, you know, the Get Men Talking group at the Headroom Cafe, presumably, sounds like a really practical, wonderful thing that people can get involved with and do. Do you have any other like nuggets of practical tips that we could all pick up, either individually or as communities, to help maintain better mental health or well-being?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are saturated around well-being content. I think that's been, you know, and that's really important, and we should hang on to that, what we can do to take care of ourselves. But I think really, I think the conversation needs to move on. And this year's Mental Health Awareness Shabbat, the theme is community, the conversation about how we can support each other, how we, you know, that idea that by being in a supportive group, and that you give the example of the men kind of being then aware of other people around them as well. I think, you know, there's something very powerful that comes from being part of a community, part of a group, being able to seek and receive support. So I think we need to really normalize that. And I think there's something about, you know, building those spaces for people. Lots of places on our website you can go to look for, you know, places for support. We commission a text-based counseling service where you can either, you know, go on there to look for materials and read up about certain subjects around mental health. You can be part of a chat room where you can speak to other people who might be struggling. You can also book a text-based counselling session with a counsellor as well. So there's lots of resources on the Jamie website to look, and also, you know, how to make a referral is also there as well. So yeah, I think the conversation's got to a really good place around mental health. I think we're much more aware. We're able to talk about it much better than we were before. But yeah, I think now it's about building mutually supportive communities is really where I think the power is for us now.
How are you going to take that into Shabbat, Miriam? Are you going to have a mental health message over Shabbat this week?
So we're really lucky. We've got our community weekend away this weekend. Mm. And I think it creates something really special in terms of being able to hold people. Our theme of the weekend is Walking Life's Journey. And that opportunity to be able to kind of share one story, acknowledge all of the kind of baggage that people are bringing with them into that weekend. What does it mean? You know, our last one was pre-pandemic. So there are people coming who came to the last one with their partner who's no longer alive. There's people who've had, you know, extraordinary challenges in those intervening years, and other people who will hopefully be able to express massive gratitude of the things that they have experienced over the last couple of years. But I think for me, the real aim of the weekend is to be able to say, like, let's create a space where we can share our stories, where we know what's going on for one another, where we can celebrate each other's kind of gratitudes and be able to support each other through the challenges, and try and take that kind of nugget of what you create in a very small environment for one weekend only and say, how do we take it home with us? How do we make sure that this is replicated all over the synagogue, all over the community, and that we make sure that those doors are open so that we define community as, you know, in as wide a place as possible. What about you, Debbie? You said that there were a number of things going on for you.
So we're going to be kicking it off at 4-ish on Friday afternoon with a cuddle up for mental well-being for our primary age kids, younger kids. We've got a story about a bag full of worries that'll be part of that, and some yoga stuff that's been framed around Jewish moves and what values are present in the idea, and theming the songs that we would normally sing, like Put the Chicken in the Pot. You know, what are the foods that actually help us stay healthy and you know, inviting the Shabbat dinosaur over because being with friends, being with other people can help support us, those sorts of things. We've got a Shabbat morning shiur looking at how the Torah portion and the plagues connect to why it's mental health Shabbat. And we then have a very special two different things happening. In our main service, our study passage will be the chair of our mental health committee talking about what they've been doing. And my sermon, I'm sure, will also reflect Mental Health Shabbat. And that theme of community, I think, will be very present. The bar mitzvah that we're celebrating this Shabbat, wonderful, wonderful family who sadly have just lost a grandparent in the last 10 days. So that sense of what it is to be together and support one another through these difficult things is very much part of that. And then alongside that, we have our parallel service, which will be hybrid, where our community care team are being helped with Rabbi Judith Levitt, who's going to be online, creating a sort of, we call it Shabbat for the Soul alternative service, where people can be in person or join online and really interact with each other around spiritually supporting ourselves through mental health crisis and having a space to discuss where we are with these things. So lots going on.
Sounds amazing. Like
incredible
sounds
stuff going on.
Absolutely.
Amazing.
They're keeping us busy. Louise, what do you do to look after yourself? Are there any practical things that are your go-to support systems?
It's a very good question, because we're notoriously bad at that in my area of work. No, I think it's a really important one. So I think there are various things I do. I think it's acknowledging there are different types of rest. And sometimes it's sleep, sometimes it's doing an activity that absorbs you. There's something about kind of getting to the flow of something that absorbs you from thinking about anything else. I find going outside really, really helpful. I think getting space. But also I think that idea of connecting to someone that you know is going to listen without judgment, knowing that someone can just is going to sit with you and listen to some of the things that are challenging for you. They're not going to try and fix it or rescue it. So it's picking out who to speak to at the right time, I think for me is something that's really, really helpful. But yeah, different types of rest and knowing, trying to checking in with myself and saying, what is it I need today in order to help manage tomorrow, I think.
How about you, Miriam?
I think I'm like the worst person to ask in those moments, because like I always want to be able to say things like, you know, I go to my Pilates class or something like that. But like I'm really bad. And my answer is always like, this Sunday probably sums it up in terms of I went to see my grandma, who's sadly, you know, very unwell and willing. She is willing her end to come. And I left her care home feeling incredibly depressed. And where did I head for? I head for Shaketastic to buy what they call a gigantic milkshake, which I'm sure it doesn't need to be that big. But it was my way, I think, of just like being able to say like these emotions are necessary, but also I need to be able to leave them kind of on my way home from the care home and walk into the house and be with my son and be with my husband and know that I'm really lucky to be able to come back into a place where, you know, we're all there for each other and it's her legacy. And it's not about the fact, you know, she's 98 and she should be allowed to be coming to the end of her life. You know, I hope for her sake, this last chapter is not too long, but to be able to say, and look what she's created, look what, you know, look what her legacy is. So for me, there's something about my go-to, I think, is trying to turn the immediate sadness into an understanding of kind of gratitude, of kind of perspective. It's easy when you have been witness to so many people who have died far too young to know that actually 98 is a great age to have got to, and this moment has to have come at some point.
So I really relate to you. I wish I could say it was Pilates or yoga. But on the other hand, I know that in lockdown, actually, one of the ways that I found I could help myself was finally, having downloaded the Couch to 5K app about 2009, maybe about a decade ago, I finally thought, okay, let's try this. And I did Couch to 5K during lockdown. I did find that the movement and the being outside and the sense of achievement as well for a big girl like me to actually run did really help me cope mentally with what was going on. I wish I could say I had continued it. And it's one of those things that every few weeks I think, oh, really, this week I'll set my alarm earlier, I'll make it happen. But the pull of bed is a little bit too strong at the moment. I'm too tired. But there's also, for me, as similar to what you were saying, Louise, that idea of doing an activity, of making something. I find crafting is a really wonderful way of doing something that's peaceful and joyful and distracting and a sense of achievement. So I often, I'll make my beaded kippot. I'll sit and watch TV and sit and bead while I do it. There's so many of those things that we know we should do and we don't quite get there.
But I think that's really important to note on, though, is that particularly if we're struggling with our mental health, like we've gone to the point where we're not coping, we're not doing the things that we need and want to do, and we're down the other end of the spectrum from just sort of keeping ourselves well, it's different, you know. So when we set ourselves targets like going out for a run, it's we're setting ourselves up to fail, because it's a really big thing. You know, going for a coffee can seem, going to get your milkshake might seem really accessible to you.
I can definitely go for coffee easier than a run.
I can definitely go for a milkshake easier than a run. But it's that, I think what we can be recognizing there is we need to set the bar a bit lower. We need to break down that thing that we know is going to help us feel better or is going to pay off in the end. And we need to set, so I think we're thinking about how we go, right, putting our trainers on and going outside for 5 minutes. I think another thing you said, Miriam, about acknowledging the sort of sadness and pain, but also having gratitude and, you know, kind of that really complicated emotions that we might feel that may seem quite conflicting. I think learning to embrace that a little bit, We're complex. We can feel both, you know, anger and gratitude at the same time sometimes, you know, and I think just we can get really hard on ourselves about that.
Amazing. So the Movement for Reformed Judaism offers a lot of support and resources on all of this, ranging from living with anxiety, addiction, and bereavement to issues like housing, asylum, illness, as well as food and financial support. And many, many of our synagogues will have resources that can help with all of those things too. You can actually join the Communities That Care initiative by using the MRJ website or by emailing careinitiative@rjuk.org. And as always, there'll be lots of links from everything that we've spoken about and what Louise has shared with us in the show notes, so you can find them online and get where you need to get to. But for urgent care, you must always still call 999 or take yourself to a hospital or your GP practice. Or you can also contact the Samaritans on 116123, where help is available around the clock every day of the week. As I said at the beginning, we're sending huge love to Rabbi Robin, who we've missed today. But we also want to say huge thanks to you, Louise Kermode from Jamie. Thank you, Miriam and Louise, for joining us. And we wish you a mental health Shabbat Shalom and hope to see you all soon. Bye.
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 Rabbit in on.